Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Dark Wraith Audio Lecture Series, specially edited academic lectures in economics and business. Lecture 11, delivered on the 21st of August of 2009. The title of this lecture is The Fundamental Economic Question.
Today, the fundamental economic problem. In the last lecture, I discussed opportunity cost, and I tried to convey to you just how important opportunity cost is in decision making of economic agents. The indirect costs, the hidden costs, are generally the largest costs that a consumer, a household, and in some cases even a business faces. Those costs are large. They compel us, even though, and I found this out, I've written about opportunity costs on my own websites, explaining it to people, and I've written it in comments at other websites explaining the idea of opportunity cost. There is this resistance to the thought that the body, the largest body of the costs that are faced by people, are not costs that they actually pay out of their pockets. And so as you go through this course and as we talk more about cost and opportunity cost and that kind of thinking we have about cost in economics, understand that you are becoming separated from how normal people think. Not from how they behave, but how they think. And that's kind of a difficult journey because there will be a time when you might actually want to tell someone about the full cost of doing something, which is not just the direct cost. And you will have them look at you, you're talking nonsense. I had a good friend of mine some years back, and these aren't around anymore, but long ago there was this company, it might actually still be around. It was called Heathkit. Have any of you ever heard of Heathkit? Well, this was a young man's geek stuff of the 60s and 70s. A company that just sold you a kit, and you would put it together to make something, like a ham radio, or something like a TV in some cases, all kinds of the electrical gadgets of the 60s and 70s. Kids and adults would buy these kits and put together very cool things, and the kits were cheap, and you spent a lot of time. You burned yourself on the soldering irons and all that, and cussed and swore, but at the end of the day, you felt like you had really accomplished something. And a fellow I know, he bought a Heathkit for a ham radio. It's a kind of communication device we used back then before texting and all that, and it cost only about $29. It took him way over 100 hours to build the thing, and for him, he had gotten something that would cost him probably just with a huge amount back in that time, and he got it for $29, and he was just so proud of himself. And I think back on that fellow now, 100 hours of his time, he was really that. That kit had actually cost him, in terms of opportunity cost, way more than it would have cost him if he just bought one at the store. But but obviously there was a personal satisfaction. He was garnering a benefit. He wouldn't have done it. He would have given up. He would have quit if it had really, really cost him more than it was worth to him. So he was obviously garnering a benefit of hundreds and hundreds of dollars in personal satisfaction from this. And you will see in your own lives, sometimes you will pick up hobbies, or you might decide, I want to get into some kind of a sport or something like that. And you'll buy some equipment, and you might pursue it for a while, and then you give up. And you just don't do it anymore. The stuff just sits around. That is not a statement of your personal laziness or sloth. Usually, that's much more a function of opportunity cost than it is anything else. Many people I know join health clubs so that they can go in and exercise and do all that kind of stuff, and then they stop going very quickly. Oh, I'm just too lazy, or they feel kind of ashamed. Well, I just can't get into that kind of stuff. Actually, most likely, it's quite rational economic behavior because they saw the upfront cost. They saw the excitement of doing this kind of stuff, getting buff and having those rippling muscles like you do. And soon it occurred to them, oh my God, this is hours of work a week, and this sucks. First of all, it hurts like hell. I'm exhausted, I'm sweaty, and those on TV I saw all those hot chicks that were there, they aren't there. But mostly it's that huge that cost of just literally spending your time doing this. Jogging, running, exercising. Yeah, there is that deterrent in the fact that it hurts, but also, much more importantly, there is the economic hidden cost, the opportunity cost that they did not think about up front. But in the end, that's what causes them to make the rational decision to say FTS. You know, fancy that scenario. So you want to keep this in mind, and I'm going to bring up opportunity costs just in a little while again here. But let me go to the fundamental economic question. And if I have repeated this, then I do apologize, but I want to start as a launching pad for where I'm going with this topic. The fundamental economic problem. How do individuals, groups, and societies allocate their scarce resources among competing possible end uses? How do individuals, groups, and societies allocate their scarce resources among competing possible end uses? Every person, every group, identifiable group, every society has to answer that fundamental question. How do we allocate our scarce resources among competing possible end uses? How do we allocate our food? How do we allocate our drinkable water? How do we allocate our land? How do we allocate our time? How do we allocate our talents? We all have to face this at the individual and household level, at the level of the groups in which we organize ourselves, and at the level of the societies themselves. Ultimately, as our world becomes more and more integrated, and I'm seeing this dramatically in my lifetime, the world itself will have to answer this question in a unified way. And this sounds almost like conspiracy theory, the one worlders, you know, the world government's going to take over and dominate us all. Unfortunately, the reality is that there will come a time, probably in your lifetimes, when that question of the largest group of all, the group that is humanity, will have to answer the question, how do we allocate the scarce resources of the earth among all of us, given that these resources are scarce and there will be competing possible end uses? We really will have to answer that as a whole planet soon enough. We see the parts of it now. And later in this course, near the end, I will talk about poverty, and I will talk about global poverty. I will talk about global income. And for a long, long time, we can look at the suffering in places like Darfur. We can look at the suffering in other places that will come and go through our time. And we can say, well, you know, that's really sad. Those children are dying, and maybe I'll put a little money into taking care of them. But at some point, we can't just set that off here on the side and turn off the television when we're sick of the commercials, because it will begin to impact on us directly. When we get to the point where the famines and the diseases and that misery and revolution that comes in other parts of the world will impact on us so directly that we can no longer pretend that it is not our problem. We have already in your lifetime seen the shockwave of it at 9/11. For all that we can say about the sickness of the terrorists who did what they did, the underlying point there is that the rest of the world and the misery and the poverty and the lack of opportunities can touch us hard and directly. Those hijackers were miserable people. They had no opportunities. They felt that they didn't have another way, even though some of them came from well-to-do families. They saw themselves radicalized, and they saw the West as the problem. In the madrasas, still to this day, in Pakistan, in parts of Afghanistan, even in India, reaching up into Asia, and even in the outlands of China, and in Eastern Europe, and in Europe itself, in Western Europe, and in the United States, there are people who feel like they are not getting theirs. They have no hope, and therefore, their choice is to destroy everything around them. Their opportunity cost of their lives, they see as low. If you value your life hugely, you're not going to waste it on some crazy ass mofo who tells you to fly into a building or put on a bomb vest. If you value your life, if you have a high opportunity cost of your time. And one of the things that happens with college, fascinating enough, is that college graduates have lower crime rates than people who don't graduate from college. Well, why is that? It's not because I'm making you better people. It's because you become more valuable people to yourselves. And therefore, you are not going to waste years of your life in prison. You're not going to take risks that people who don't value their lives will take. So this problem, the fundamental economic problem, isn't just about individuals, households, groups, and individual societies anymore. It is becoming more and more the fundamental economic problem of the earth. And until we can find ways to get people off the earth and out into the colonies, which will not come for about a century yet in any significant way at all, we're going to have to deal with this problem where the resources of the earth have to be allocated more and more stringently among the competing possible end uses. Now, this problem breaks down into three questions. Three questions. What to produce? Every group, an individual, has to answer this. What to produce, given that we have scarce resources we have to allocate? How to produce it, given, again, that we have scarce resources that have to be allocated? And for whom to produce it? We all have to answer those. Every society has to answer the question, what to produce? How to produce it? For whom to produce it? Because our resources of production are scarce. And for us here, and this is something, I guess, you know, I've been teaching this subject for so many years. It's like I want to just get automatic, and then almost like a tape recorder. But as time goes on, I keep seeing more and more depth, and sometimes I actually see it from your perspective. These three questions actually kind of look arcane to a person in a high Western civilization. What do you mean? What to produce? You know, we produce how to produce it? Well, you know, that's kind of like, don't we take management courses for that kind of stuff? And for whom to produce it? You know, what kind of a question is that? These questions actually bite harder in less organized, less wealthy societies. But they are here, and in our society, it is so automatic how it's done that even when there are small deviations, when the paradigm shifts a little bit, oh God, it can become an ugly incident. what is happening right now with this healthcare debate. You've seen, I hope at least some of you have seen these town hall meetings where these crazies are pounding on the door, Obama is Hitler, come on, really? Obama's black, Hitler was white. But underneath it, they are expressing, and my liberal friends are just shocked, horrified by these people and their ridiculous attitude. But I've actually written a couple of articles where I'm trying to explain, no, it's not just a matter that these are a bunch of zombies being ordered out into the streets by Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. There really is something deeper going on. When a society has such automated ways of doing things, and it's so obvious how things are supposed to work and how they've always worked, when there is a recognition that we need to change something, that's difficult for anyone. And sometimes the solutions are bad solutions, and sometimes the reactions to the solutions are way over the top. But it's not just a matter of saying, well, these right-wingers who are disrupting these town halls are crazy zombies. Well, maybe they are, or maybe they are. I can't comment on that. But really, they are an expression of the shift from how we've done things or how they think we've been doing things all along. Look, societies allocate their scarce resources in different ways. The fundamental economic problem expressed through those three questions is answered differently by different societies. Now, I'm going to break this down really into pure solutions, three pure solutions, but then I'll quickly go back and say, well, they blur in reality. But the three basic ways that the fundamental economic problem is answered at the societal level are these. There is the traditional economy. The traditional economy. Resources in a traditional economy, scarce resources in a traditional economy, are allocated among possible competing end uses by custom, by tradition. So oftentimes by ancient law, scribal law. And you would see that very much. And I'm going to go back to this because actually we have a different tendency in our economy, but inside of our other economy, we have a lot of a traditional economy. And in fact, I address this when I teach marketing classes. I address it head on, that there really is a traditional economy underneath our other economy, which I'll cover here in a minute. But if you read biblical literature of the Old Testament, you will most decidedly see a traditional economy being described. Over and over again, you see it in there. Ancient scribal law, this is how we do this. This is how we do that. This is how we give to, this is how we move these resources to their possible competing end uses. In fact, at one point, I believe it is in the Pentateuch, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. That's a traditional. Well, why are we doing it this way? Because that's the way it's supposed to be done. That's what Moses told us to do. That it's just our tradition to do it that way. Well, why do we not eat these foods that are available to us, like shrimp and shellfish? Because we're not supposed to. Duh. Dude, that's food. No, we just don't do that. You see, the rationality, you might say, well, that's irrational. If people are starving, why wouldn't they eat these things? It's just they don't do it. You just don't do it. In parts of some countries where animals are considered to be possible reincarnations of people, they will starve before they would eat a cow. And I've had my friends, typical Western American, Western civilization yuppies, well, they are starving and it's just their own damn fault because they won't eat their cows because they think their cow is their uncle. For them, it is far, far more than that. You just don't do that. You don't. People could starve, yeah, but you don't eat that cow. That cow could be your mother. Not that your mother's big and fat, but you see, from our perspective, it's just irrational. From theirs, you just don't do that. You don't. That's not how it works. And we try to impose our ways. You know, we will bring civilization. You will eat beef and you will like it. But for them, we are really, really disrupting what is their system. Yeah, but their system sucks. People starve. Kids are suffering. That's what they do. That's their choice. The next one is the command economy. The command economy allocates the scarce resources among possible competing end uses through a central authority. There is some powerful central figure. It could be an individual, but it could also be a group that makes all the decisions about how to allocate the scarce resources. Now, the purest form of this, probably still in existence, might be North Korea. North Korea, under Kim Dae-jung and then the current ruler. And it will continue to be that way. Just the central authority, through dear leader, Kim Jong-il, says, this is how it's done. This goes here, that goes there. At the height of the Soviet Empire, the communist system that they had was very much this way, where the central Politburo and all of these agencies, they decided everything, even down to where you would live, how big a place you would get to live in, what food you could have, what job you got, how much education you achieved. They decided it. And in China, it was that way until recent years. But even now, there is still a great deal of central command from the central authority that decides a lot of things. Even down to the point in China where, I don't know if you're aware of it, they have a one-child policy. They decide how many kids you have, even there, and that has some very nasty, perverse effects, but they're willing to live with those effects, simply because that's the way it works in their economy. Now, the last one, ours, is the market economy. In a market economy, the scarce resources are allocated among possible competing end uses by the prices that are set by supply and demand conditions. Adam Smith, whom I mentioned in the first couple of lectures, he was very much a promoter of the market economy. And he talked about the invisible hand allocating the scarce resources. Well, what he was talking about was prices. Prices decide. Now, let me take you back through these economies and how they are answering the fundamental three-part question. A market economy. What to produce? What makes you a profit? How to produce it? As cheaply as possible. For whom to produce it? For whoever can afford it. Again, what to produce? What makes you a profit? How to produce it? The cheapest way possible. Duh. For whom to produce it? For people who can afford it. That's just how it works. Now, the command economy. What to produce? What we are told by the central authority to produce. How to produce it? By how the central authority tells us to produce it. For whom to produce it? For those that the central authority tells us to make it for. A traditional economy, what to produce? Well, what the old ways tell us to produce. How to produce it? By the old ways, by the customary traditional ways. You know, duh. For whom to produce it? For the people we are supposed to produce it for. You know, duh. Again, I emphasize, yes, I am a market economist. I'm somewhat of a conservative, although I hate to use that word anymore with what conservatism has become. But you'll hear me promote market economy. That's what we teach in American colleges and universities, is market economy economics. But I do not want you to think that these have to be dismissed as irrelevant. They are very relevant to the societies in which they are the dominant economic model. They mean as much to those people as ours does to us. And now I can talk about the blurring that goes on across these. Let's talk about, and this is one where you'll get a similar lecture if you ever took a marketing course from me. Let's talk about a market economy and a traditional economy. They sound like they're completely different. You see, ours is so market-oriented that we just don't think about the fundamental problems, what to produce, how to produce it, for whom to produce it. But underneath it, there is a huge amount of a traditional economy. And I'm going to tell you right now, someday, 30 years from now, woman, you will be walking down the aisle of Walmart. Waddle, 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 waddle. And you'll reach up for the laundry detergent. And you will realize this is the same laundry detergent my mother used. That's not a rational economic decision. That's tradition. And then it'll get worse. Because suddenly you'll stop dead, look down at your pants and scream, "Ah! My mom's polyester pants! I'm wearing them!" Not rational economic, market-oriented economics at all. A traditional behavior driven by custom. Someday, when you are 55 years old, you will go to the mirror, nude, sir. And you'll suck in your stomach. Yeah, I still got it. And then you'll realize, oh my God, that belly is coming out like my dad's. Wait a minute, what's that in my cabinet? That's the same blue pills my daddy had. I never knew what they were for. Now I know. Oh God, I'm my dad. Someday you'll reach for a beer. You'll go to a burger joint. It will be the ones that you did your whole life. Once you get over your wild and crazy, oh, you'll go back to dad and mom, to the uncles and the aunts, to all the things that were there in your youth. You will revert. You will come back. As a matter of fact, in marketing, all the time, we are marketing wild and crazy, new, improved. But underneath it, we are wanting to make sure that we let everyone know that it's not all that different from what they've seen before. We can't scare people away from their anchors in custom and tradition. See, and that's one of the fun things about marketing, is making people feel like they're wild and crazy, breaking all the rules, but making sure that all the time we're helping them feel like they are part of a long tradition. No, very few people really want to break from the past. Really, even if you hate your mom and dad, even if you hated your childhood, you will fall as an apple very close to the tree of your family, of your blood, of your clan, of your genes. It'll come back to you. Most of it will. Trust me, it will. And so, even in a market economy, we produce very traditional things. Our customs, our laws compel us to return always to things that are old, things that are acceptable, things that are customary. And then in our economy, though, we do accommodate the new, but we accommodate the new by making sure that it's very much like the old. Market and command. Let's talk market and command economy. I come from the era of the Cold War. Not one of you in here is old enough to remember the Cold War. For one thing, let me tell you, the Cold War was so cool. Better spy novels, better movies, all kinds of interesting intrigue, the wonderful world of mutually assured destruction. We all thought maybe one of these days we were going to nuke each other back to the Stone Age. Very cool stuff. But if you traveled in Eastern Europe in the black heart of the Soviet Empire, the ultimate command economy. A pack of cool cigarettes could get you a meal, a girl for the night, and a taxi ride. A $20 bill, you could own half of the damn Berlin Wall. Market economy was there under the surface. You could get anything you want if you had the money for it. There was a market economy thriving all through that era. It was always there. And let's look at the other side of it. Well, that's a socialist idea, that their damn healthcare. You're going, oh, duh. We have all kinds of command components to our economy. I like to tell people at universities and colleges, public universities and colleges, you and I are all welfare queens. We pay, you guys pay about a third of the cost of your education here. I suck at the trough, that the hog trough of the public welfare system. We build prisons. That's nothing but welfare for cities and municipalities for jobs. We hire more and more police and say, boogie, 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 bad man out there to get you. We put up cameras. Well, they're for your protection. Oh, like hell they are. They are fiscal stimulators that give people jobs. Welfare is all over the place. Command economy, the government deciding how to allocate the scarce resources among competing possible end uses. You hear that, I don't want to go down the road of socialism. Well, we are already well down that road, good people. And if you don't believe it, then why don't you try paying the full cost of this education? I'm a very expensive person, quite literally. But we are social. We have socialist aspects. We are market-oriented. We prefer market solutions. As a matter of fact, I'm writing right now about why my criticisms of the healthcare legislation, they're not this crazy that, well, they're going to have death panel. Oh, shut the hell up. But there are defects. We could have more market-oriented solutions. Defects in the healthcare industry. Price transparency, something you'll learn a lot about in this course. How much does it cost? Let me ask you that. How much would it cost for you to go to the emergency room and get 10 stitches if you cut yourself with a knife? You do not know. You see, the prices are hidden from you. You are denied one of the powers of a free market, which is to be able to see prices and vote with your dollars on prices. That's a huge defect. It's a market failure. And it's a collusive market failure. And so when I criticize the healthcare reform legislation, I approach it from the fact that we need stronger laws and an upgrade of our antitrust laws to deal with what has happened to the concentration of market power. And that's another term you'll hear later in the course quite a bit, market power, in our healthcare and pharmaceutical industries. But all that aside, the idea that we do not have socialist aspects, command economy aspects in our economy, oh, come on, we have them all the time. And especially at the household level, most good households are not market-driven. They're command economies. You have a daughter, is that right? Have you ever said, because I said so? That's not market. That's command. My ass is in command. So we live under all kinds of different regimes. And there's the next point that I want to make. Remember I said, how do individuals, groups, and societies allocate scarce resources among competing possible end uses? Well, there's not a unified answer within a given society. The society might have one way, but groups within that society might have very different ways of doing things, have a much more oriented towards some other way of doing things in their groups. For example, there has been sociological research. I was reading an excellent article about youth culture. And these people were not economics at all. They were sociology. But I was reading into it some fascinating things, that even though the children, the young people, are operating within a broadly market economy, they themselves are strongly command-oriented within their groups, with group decision-making that is almost what we call herd-oriented. The command is actually the entire globe of the group. And the reason you see outsiders, kids who go goth and all of that, is because their particular psychological makeup does not like that group behavior. You might think, well, goths are all acting alike. No, they are actually separating themselves because they don't want to act like the herd, so they want to rebel against the command structure of their group as much as against the command structure of their households. Quite often, the goth, especially some of the variations, full goth Lolita, emo goth, and all that kind of stuff, they're rebelling not against parents as much as they are rebelling against herd behavior, the command-oriented herd behavior of their peer groups. So you'll see different, and it's fascinating if you start to think about it, what kind of a group are you? Where do you prefer to be? We have about 20% of the people in this country, according to Professor Robert Altmaier, who did some phenomenal research, who are what are called right-wing authoritarian followers. They just want to be told what to think. That's their way. They do not introspect. And that's why trying to reason with them by normal traditional logical methods we use in colleges doesn't work. And we get frustrated. It's because they didn't think this up themselves, so you can't get them to think their way out of their ridiculous thoughts. And so the Altmaier's research points to a fascinating group that is heavily command-oriented. Did any of you ever see the movie V for Vendetta? Remember that commentator who was sort of like a parody of Rush Limbaugh? He'd look at the screen like this and he'd say, "Let me tell you what I think." That is the leader of a right-wing authoritarian follower. They want someone to tell them what to think. If you don't believe me, this research was stunning. These people are highly identifiable. Approximately 20% of the population of the United States falls into this. They don't want to think. They want to be told what to think. They want it to be simple. They want it to be harsh. And they want it to be actionable so that they can use it. They don't want to think their way through it. That's high command orientation, but within a market economy, with socialist aspects to it. Fascinating as it is. I don't want to overemphasize these purities, really, because they really do blend all through a society. A society is a hustle and flow of all of these different economies. But we can talk about a dominant model. And we do know, and this is the stuff, I mean, if you went to grad school in economics, they'd just blow your ass away with math. But really, really, it's the same stuff I teach you. It's just that they like to knock you dead with some of the most awesome mathematics you would ever imagine. And you do get some subtle results that are difficult to explain at the micro level and macro level, but really, it's all about the same. But the one thing that we do teach in American economic schools is that the more market-oriented the economy is, the more efficient in terms of the use of scarce resources it is. The further you deviate from the prices allocating the scarce resources, the less efficient the resource allocation and use becomes. That's fine. We do have to have efficiency, and it definitely in a world of scarcity, and especially with resources that are scarce, the efficiency has to be high. But we can't just say it's all about market-oriented economies, it's all about efficiencies. Sometimes we have to step away from just pure efficiency and ask ourselves, what does tradition tell us? Efficiency? Come on. An old person who's sick? Let the person die. Come on, that's obviously the most efficient way. Let's get real here. But we know very well that we act like that too much. We have lost everything, and we cannot deny in our traditions that we value the old. We value the sick. We want them to be better, not because there's a money aspect to it, that they'll be more productive and we'll get them back into workflow and all that kind of stuff, cost-benefit analysis. Sometimes we do have to revert to tradition. It is not a matter of efficiency and cost-benefit analysis. It's just the question of who the hell we are and how dare we we decide the end of the life of a person who really doesn't want to die yet, who has a few things to say, and maybe has one more hug left in him. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.